it worth the waiting for? If we live till 84, all we ever get is gruel. Every day we say a prayer, will they change the bill of fare? Still we get the same old gruel. There's not a crust, not a crumb. Can we find, can we beg, can we borrow or cash? But there's nothing to stop us from getting a thrill when we all
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. The history of food is our topic this afternoon. For hundreds of years in Britain, vegetables were believed to be a source of disease. In ancient Egypt, radishes frequently served as a source of oil for embalming bodies. The candy bar? Younger than our republic. Today, to hunt and gather means a trip to the supermarket, but for most of our history, food was a lot of work and dangerous work at that. Listeners, this afternoon I welcome your questions for historian Kenneth Kuipel. He's co-editor with his wife of the Cambridge World History of Food. He is also one of the work's authors. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Kenneth Kuipel is Distinguished University Professor of History at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. His research and teaching interests include Latin America and the history of medicine, disease, and nutrition. He's interested in the connections between food and human history from Paleolithic times to the present. The Cambridge World History of Food is a reference work contained in two volumes and running more than 2,000 pages. The work contains much of what is known about the history of food and nutrition. It was 10 years in the making. Again, those telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Professor Kuipel, good afternoon. Welcome.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you.
I wanted to give credit where credit is due, and I noted that you and your wife are the history's co-editors, and I would like for listeners to know her name, but I'm afraid I'd make a mess of it.
Well, it's complicated. It's German. Kriemhild.
Kriemhild.
Uh-huh.
It's a very nice name. Very nice name. So when and how did your interest in food and history begin?
Gradually. I began, I suppose, as an historical demographer, and then became interested in why people died, and that got me into disease. And then from there I went into questions of human health, and that brought up food and nutrition, and here we are.
Hmm. As a result of working on this project, did you learn about foods you weren't aware of previously?
Oh, sure. The multitude of plant foods alone. That we're still trying to get a handle on. In other words, we're doing another book and expanding the plant food part. But we listed over 1,000 of them, and in this first go around. And in New Zealand, in Australia, in different parts of the world, they have foods that, of course, I've never heard of.
Yeah.
But I'd like to go and find out about them.
Yeah. Well, the history contains a dictionary of the world's plant foods, and.
That's right.
I haven't put my hands on this magnificent reference work, but I have a wonderful press packet. And anyway, the press packet lets me know that there are all kinds of wild plant foods out there. It gives two examples, from ackee to zamia.
Yeah, ackee.
Ackee. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about these two plant foods?
Well, ackee, to begin with, is an interesting an interesting plant that came to Jamaica in particular from West Africa. And it's the part of that famous marriage of that Harry Belafonte sings about, Aki Rice and Fisher Nice. And the fish in question, of course, was the salted codfish. And they still enjoy that dish today, and I've been fortunate enough to have been in Jamaica and eaten it. The only difficulty with aki is that it's got to be not picked up off the ground, because then it turns poisonous, and lots of children in Jamaica died before they figured that one out.
Wow. And the...
Zamia?
Zamia.
Or Zamia is a... it's a root, very much like, similar, I suppose, to yucca or manioc. We have it in the southeastern United States as well as the West Indies. And it's a root that's pounded and grated and dried and boiled and mashed, washed. And all of this they do to get rid of a poison, very much like manioc. And then it was baked into bread. And as a matter of fact, the Spanish who first arrived in the West Indies spent a lot of time eating Zamia bread.
Interesting. Well, both of these plant foods, you have to be careful with them.
Yes, yes, and yet it's amazing how many plants we eat that we don't realize we could or should be careful with. Potatoes, for example, are very often the skins are toxic, particularly if they're green. And celery has all kinds of toxins. And as a matter of fact, they bred celery to the point where it will defend itself so well against predators, in other words, insects and whatnot, that very often you'll have grocery clerks breaking out.
Really?
And so they always know when they've done bred that celery a little bit too much when they get an epidemic of this thing in the produce departments.
That's wild. There has to have been a whole lot of trial and error and a lot of testing that we've done over the years.
A few million years, yeah.
A few million years.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, it was from what we, what the bioanthropologists tell me, it's was very often the case that back in the days of the hunter-gatherers, it was the women and children who got to taste all the new things and help keep down the size of families, I guess. But then they domesticated the dog, and after that, the dog got the job and became our first experimental animal.
Interesting. So it was the dog led us to where we are today.
Well, and yes, more ways than one, because about 14,000 years ago, the dog and was a wolf then, and wolves and humans joined forces. And certainly their combined hunting skills meant that humans were much more successful than ever before. And that then led to population increases. And that in turn meant that we had to do something besides hunt. And so we invented agriculture.
Mm.
So, yeah, the dog figured pretty prominently in all.
Yeah. And it's interesting to think that dogs... for better, for worse, have led us to where we are, the domestication of the dog, because apparently those hunter-gatherers did better nutritionally than those who switched to herding and growing. Is that right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the reason for it is first of all, the diet was really heavy in animal protein, but not, of course, the kind of couch potato beef that we eat today. Rather, it was relatively fat-free. And then they ate an amazing variety of things. And we know some of this just by keeping an eye on contemporary hunter-gatherers. The Kumsan, for example, and on the edge of the Kalahari Desert, certainly this is not the best, by far, spot to be hunter-gathering, and clearly earlier hunter-gatherers had much better locations. Still, the Kumsan eat a amazing variety of things, and humans did the same as hunter-gatherers. Then they settled into agriculture, and they generally grew a single crop and invested their energy in rice in one place and barley or wheat in another, and of course, in the Americas, maize. And the result of that was that the diet narrowed tremendously. And we know, too, that the diet certainly was less offered less in the way of animal protein, a good deal less, or just plain whole protein, because people shrunk. In other words, the hunter-gatherers of 25,000 years ago were about 6 inches taller than the Stone Age or Bronze Age. I'm sorry, farmers of about 4,000 years ago, and people were continuing to shrink until, it was just the beginning of the 20th century that some peoples began to attain the stature of our ancient ancestors.
Yeah. In the chapter that you wrote on this topic for the history, you also point out that in hunter-gatherer days, 5 pounds of food required to provide 3,000 calories. Today, 5 pounds of food packs a big punch.
Upwards
of 9,000 calories.
Yeah.
You put 5 pounds of Big Macs on the table.
Right. Well, the diet certainly changed, and I suppose that's one of the reasons that, I mean, now in the 20th century, or beginning of the 21st century, we've all got too much to eat.
Mm.
And so we've got a situation in this country, at least, where most, meaning over half of the people over 25 years of age, are victims of what we're calling an obesity epidemic.
Yeah. Well, our earliest human ancestors maybe then can teach us to get moving and to eat a wider variety of foods. Can they teach us anything else about what would be a better diet or an ideal diet?
Well, I think what we learn from them is that a wide variety of foods, but you see, so many of the things that we eat today, they didn't eat, and so this brings up a number of problems. For example, they did not eat cereals. None of the superfoods that we grow now were consumed then. And they, in other words, of the basic food groups, and also the dairy, there was no milk. And not surprisingly, of course, these two groups cause a lot of health problems today. Celiac disease is one of them, for example, with wheat and gluten. But also there's lactose intolerance. Most of the world's peoples can't drink milk.
Hmm.
So I suppose one of the things that we could learn from the hunter-gatherers is we're really programmed nutritionally, in many respects, to eat the kinds of things they did. And when we don't, I suppose we do it with some penalty to our health.
Hmm. Interesting. Kenneth Kuipel is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is co-editor of the Cambridge World History of Food. He's also one of the work's authors. He is a distinguished university professor of history at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you've got questions about food history, give us a call this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. The livestock industry in Europe is being devastated by mad cow disease and foot and mouth disease. The British diet, I imagine, has changed dramatically recently.
Well, I suppose it has.
Yeah.
Although I was in London here a few months ago to visit my son, who took me to a restaurant where they served rare beef. And one finally said, well, gee, you know, the risk is low, and I suppose it is with the mad cow disease. There is no risk to humans from the hoof and mouth. On the other hand,
right,
it doesn't do the animals any good.
Well, it I would also imagine that it could mean economically you wouldn't have as much, you wouldn't be eating as much meat.
Or different kinds.
Yeah, different kinds. You would you'd turn to chicken or fish, that kind of thing. But
right.
Anyway, with these two things that are going on, You know, I'm wondering, have there been similar catastrophes in history, and did they have a long-term effect on diet, what we eat?
That's a good question. Certainly throughout history, and we can find it in the Bible, there were outbreaks of anthrax that just devastated animal populations, and humans, too, if they got too close to it. But I don't know that it really did change anything. Ultimately, it's just that we've had recurring epidemics of these kinds of things that hit animal populations.
Hmm. Does the Cambridge World History of Food deal with food safety issues?
Well, sure. And food safety, food additives, and concerns there, and certainly the genetic engineering of foods, and then we've got a marvelous chapter on pressure groups, lobbies that seem to ensure that we don't get necessarily the foods we ought to get, because of the various associations that are pretty powerful in Washington.
Mm. How did you decide what should go into a world history of food?
Well, we'd finished another project. That was the Cambridge World History of Human Disease. And as we were finishing that up, it occurred to us that what we might want to do is take the chance to wrap up what we know or think we know about human health as a new century and new millennium, for that matter, was getting underway. And so that's what got us to work in food and nutrition, maybe probably out of habit. For a while, we continued to work mostly on matters of ill health, in other words, the various nutritional diseases and that kind of thing. But then food began to kind of take over, and then as that happened, I think we got pretty much the format we wanted today. In other words, a regional treatment of all the areas of the world and what they've eaten over time, and then moving back to the book begins, of course, with those hunter gatherers we've been talking about. And then we get into the invention of agriculture. In other words, the domestication of every one of the important staple foods and as well as meat animals and fish and this sort of thing. And then we get into water and all the beverages. And then it just began to kind of take its own life.
I wonder, you know, it's such an undertaking. I wonder, did you come to a point where you knew that's it, we've got it, or was it a matter of we've got to stop now?
Yeah. Probably a little of both. Somehow, you know, it was pretty obvious that yes, we could have tossed in a couple more things, but we'd pretty well gotten the job done.
Mm.
But it was just that job. Now we're working on, as I say, two more books. One is an expansion of the food dictionary, and then the other is a short history. In other words, this two-volume set has a general introduction that pretty well points the way, but that's the only method by which one is going to get a succinct big picture.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're going to do is a short history that'll give one the big picture. One of our reviewers said that this one was too heavy to carry and too dangerous to drop.
Well, it will be great to have a shorter history, so that you know, for us popular readers, we can delve into it. The other thing I wanted to ask you about working on this history is that the disciplines involved, quite a range.
Yeah, we've said it's from anthropology to zoology, and pretty much everything in between that has to do with food or food and medicine, or food and nutrition. Mm. And so, yeah, it was quite a job. Not because it gave us a translating task. If it was going to be a coherent world history, then what we had to do was to rewrite these various practitioners of different disciplines so that it would read a lot smoother. Otherwise, you have to get accustomed to all the jargons from the all the different disciplines.
Yeah, you got to translate all the buzzwords.
Yep.
Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I've got two questions. I guess I'll ask them one at a time. The first one is, I'm happy you're there because I've heard that, but I haven't been able to verify this anywhere, so I'm beginning to think I heard wrong. But I heard that when we stopped eating, at some point we must have stopped eating insects on a regular basis, and that there's some sort of nutrient, trace nutrient, I suppose, that we thereby lost. And can you verify that? Does that sound true at all?
Well, half of it sounds true. In other words, certainly it was the case that insects were a big part of the diets of some people. As a matter of fact, still are. Yet, I don't necessarily see how there could be a single trace element that would be common to all insects. For example, termites and are eaten widely, and so are caterpillars, and yet I don't really see a connection there.
Nothing unique to the insect.
Oh, I'm not saying that this is wrong. I've never heard of it.
Okay. Well, here's another oddball one for you. There's a publication called the Chicago Reader in Chicago, published out of Chicago, of course, and it's got this column called Straight Dope. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's they answer really oddball questions. And about a week ago last Friday, they had the question, somebody had sent in the question, is it true that somewhere in Asia that they eat monkey brains? And they went on to say that in their answer, they said that if they're not even sure if that was ever true, but they cited a couple of anecdotes where people had a live monkey and cracked open its skull and ate its brains, kind of like the movie Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I was just wondering if you've run across any kind.
I've heard of that. As a matter of fact, just the other day I was reading somebody who said that they had enjoyed monkey brains right out of the skull.
So you too have heard it, but
yes,
but haven't seen it yourself.
Never.
Okay.
Not sure I'd like to either.
Right. Thanks.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go and talk with a listener in Terre Haute on line four. Hi.
Hi. Great show. I wanted to ask about sour milk products. The Russians have a lot of things like kefir, sour milk or cultured milk, and besides yogurt and things like that. And it's very good and tasty, but what kind of role, could you talk about those in the human diet and they bring up their kids on kefir and sour milk and all of those things, and then they have this baked milk, and then baked milk that's been converted into some sour milk product, and we don't have any of these things here, but you can get them in Russian or Polish or Ukrainian grocery stores. But what importance are they to the human diet? Can you talk about those in general?
Yeah, in this case, very important because sour milk products, as a rule, are the most prevalent where people can't drink regular milk because they're lactose intolerant. And as soon as you sour the milk, you get rid of some of the enough in most cases of the lactose. Without sour milk, a lot of people wouldn't have eaten any, or rather consumed any milk at all.
Okay.
Then another interesting one is kumis, which is mare's milk. And that, of course, was a favorite and still is of the tribes on the Russian steppes.
Uh-huh. Now, I understand that the potato was not native to Russia, that was brought to Russia later on. Can you confirm this?
Oh, sure. The potato is American.
Uh-huh.
And as a matter of fact, it's we never heard even further than that. It comes from the Andes region, and still today they have more potatoes than, in other words, you know, we're used to seeing a half a dozen different kinds in the supermarket. You go to Lima, Peru, and you'll see thousands of different varieties.
Mm. Ah, okay. And then the original staple of the Russian diet, I understand, was the buckwheat. Which is buckwheat groats or something like that.
So, yeah, I guess it depends on where you are. Rye has been awful important in the Russian diet as well.
Uh-huh. Rye. Okay. All right, well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions about food history are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, historian Kenneth Kiepel, one of the editors of the Cambridge World History of Food. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. The first caller this afternoon who asked about insects and monkeys raises a topic in my mind, and that is food prejudices and taboos.
Uh-huh.
What are some of the more interesting food prejudices and taboos that are out there that that you've learned about over time?
Well, of course, we know the and are all familiar with the Jewish food prohibition. And any seafoods that doesn't have fins, and to a large extent, this is the also the Muslim food taboos or the taboos of Islam, with some variations. The Christians had relatively few food taboos, but they sure did make life tough the Catholic Church because of the meatless days that for a while during the medieval period, I think about half the days you couldn't eat meat.
Wow.
So it wasn't just Lent and Fridays. Then when you go to other areas of the world, in Africa, for example, parts of West Africa, eggs are taboo. And part of that, I guess, is economic. In other words, if you eat the egg, you don't get the chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And but then you get into a chicken-egg proposition there because in many cases where the egg is taboo, or at least where it has been, so was animal protein very short, and they could have used the eggs.
In India, the cattle.
Right.
And it seems to me this also makes sense from an economic standpoint is... you use the cattle for the dairy cow for dairy, and that provides a lot of nutrition. It provides butter, ghee, yogurt,
right.
Milk, all those kinds of things. So, you know, not slaughtering cattle makes makes some sense. There.
Yeah, and there have been all kinds of efforts to put the Jewish food prohibitions into some kind of economic context, or at least a medical one. But so far, nobody's made a very convincing argument.
Yeah. Do those prohibitions have to do with food safety, though?
Well, in some cases, it would seem so. But on the other hand, the things that were not prohibited are also or can also be very harmful too. So, as I say, no one's been able to make a complete sense out of this yet. But I'm sure they will someday.
Yeah. Today we're very interested in food, and we've got this word out there, foodie.
Yeah.
Have there been, the Romans spring to mind immediately, of course, but have there been other periods in history when people were foodies, they were interested in cooking and eating well, and food was both sustenance and entertainment?
Well, you mentioned the Romans, and of course it wasn't just the Romans, but it was the, you know, the upper class of the Romans that did the party going and the feasting and so on and so forth, and that was the same throughout the Middle Ages in Europe, that banquets were for the well-to-do were pretty elaborate affairs. They would do swans, for example, and then cook the swan and pull all the feathers back on it, and the idea was to make them look very lifelike, and peacocks as well. And certainly the Chinese court throughout history was a gourmand court, and I suppose that upper classes throughout history have all done pretty well in the gourmand department.
Mm. I wonder, you know, this seems so strange to me, the Romans and their gorging themselves, and then gouging themselves. You know, how does such an idea like that take hold? How does a food fashion, if you will, take hold?
Well, clearly it became the thing to do, and it wasn't just a matter of going down to the market buying something elegant. They all had their pools, the wealthy, of course, where they raised their own fish, and they would pay tremendous amounts of money for special kinds of fish. And then, yes, they had their vomitoriums to get rid of the food so they could start over. On the other hand, they had those probably before the gorging caught on, because the Romans were kind of notorious for fiddling around with their wines in particular, but adulterating foods in general as well. And they added an awful lot of lead to try to cut down on the acidic quality of their wines. And then, of course, this wine was drunk out of mostly lead vessels, and that's probably one more reason for the vomitoriums, because they were taking enough lead to give them lead poisoning, and that brings on tremendous stomach cramps.
So they were sick.
Yep.
Wow. Well, we've talked just touched the tip of the wine iceberg. There are also many other beverages that have been very important throughout history. Maybe we could talk about these for a couple of minutes. Two that spring right to mind: beer and coffee.
Okay. Beer goes all the way back to the Sumerians, to 3000 BC at least, probably earlier. As a matter of fact, an argument has been made that the reason people settled into agriculture was so they could grow grain to make beer with. Which, of course, turns the common notion that beer followed the growing of grain for food. And there's probably some truth to it, because the Sumerians did apparently put about one quarter of their grain crop into beer. That was not the beer we know today, because it did not have hops. It was an unhopped ale, I suppose is a better word than beer. And we don't get a hopped beer till, well, relatively recently. But why was it so popular? And then why did wine come along to be popular as well? And the answer there is that when people started to settle down into their sedentary communities to be farmers, they fouled their water supply almost immediately. And the thing about beer and wine was that it was purified, and so it wouldn't make you sick, but the water probably would. And then later on, but much later, we get coffee and tea. And cocoa, as far as that's concerned, they all came about the same time. And to Europe. And there, of course, you needed to boil water. And so that kept people from getting sick.
Yeah.
And so in every case, our choice of beverages historically has been one of avoiding water. Or just taking another in purer form.
Soiling our nest.
Yeah.
Let's talk with another listener, this one in Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Thank you. There's beer and then there's beer. Some beer is really swill and other stuff is grown with great care. Reminds me of a short joke. Somebody sent in a homebrew preparation for analysis, and the assessment came back and said, "Your horse has diabetes." But getting down to something more in the food area, I understand that soy is regarded highly, but recently there have been some observations that fermented soy has got more attributes that have going for it than the regular straight, plain, regular soy. And other fermented products seem to have a beneficial aspect in the health, digestive and...
Well, you're talking about soy sauce and...
Well, not that so much. I guess maybe tempeh and other things that are fermented. I'm not familiar. I was just wondering if you'd heard about it. This is a new slant or angle on the merits of soy, that it's preferred. Health benefits are more obtainable through a fermented type of soy. It's a new thing in the last month or two that's been brought out.
Hmm. Well, probably makes some sense. Certainly in Japan, their soy sauce or sauces,
and the miso and other things.
Yeah, they had no rock salt deposits in Japan, and so they had no salt to speak of. But when you ferment soy, you get salt, and so on the Japanese table, the soy sauce or whatever has been the salt shaker.
And then further commenting upon the Asians' longevity, I hear that they regard meat as a condiment rather than a main course in great respect to things of women in certain parts of Japan that are considered the longevity record breakers right now, living into the 80s on average, do regard meat that way, as a condiment rather than a main item. And today's a good day to think about it. In this state, we have a great meat out campaign, so that people are urged not to eat meat today. But it leads me to another question about given...
Let me just make one comment here before I forget it. As far as the meat and soy is concerned, they don't need the meat for animal protein because you get the equivalent of animal protein out of soy. It means it's the only vegetable that gives you a whole protein. And so if you're eating soy products, then you're eating the equivalent of meat.
Senator McGovern recently was around the country with his book on hunger.
Uh-huh.
And he's part of the international program to help hunger. And when he spoke to the group in Rome, I guess where there's a center dealing with that, they said, what is the most important thing we can do regarding hunger? And he said, water, 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 because... considering the state of the world and the water shortage and the politics of water, it's going to become a very critical factor. And like here just this week, they talked about a drought in Washington State, a drought in Florida.
Right.
And on, so we're continually having to deal with that. But thank you very much for your insight.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Any comment on the water comment?
No, not really. I mean, how can you comment on truth?
Yeah.
It's a sad situation.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about food, the history of food. Our guest is Kenneth Kiepel, Distinguished University Professor of History at Bowling Green State University in Ohio and co-editor of the Cambridge World History of Food. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Back to beverages. Coffee and tea, they came about the same time?
Yeah. Coffee began along the Red Sea, and it spread throughout the Muslim world first. And the thing that helped it spread there was the fact that Islamic law began to prohibit alcoholic beverages. And so that made coffee enormously popular, at least Europe, somewhere around the 16th century. There was the 1500s, just about the same time that the Dutch and then after them the English were moving into the East, and they began to bring back tea. Then, of course, in the Americas, cacao was discovered, and although it was used in Spain for quite a while, it began to seep out, if you will, into other parts of Europe. And as I say, all these happened about the same time, which is why we get, sadly, an enormous increase in the slave trade and in the sugar plantations that the slave operated.
Mm-hmm. Tea, though, about this time, the 15th, 16th century, it's coming to Europe, but in Asia, my guess is it would be much older.
Oh, yes. I was being very Eurocentric there. Tea goes back at least 2,000 years before the Common Era. Then it caught on rather spasmodically. Of course, it became the the drink of the court, and then finally the common people began to accept it. But that was not until much, much later, maybe the 16th century.
Very interesting.
And then I mentioned, of course, the Dutch and the English, but I should have mentioned the Portuguese. They were there first.
Some time ago, I read that until coffee was the beverage, our morning beverage, people drank beer throughout the day. So I suppose coffee and tea came along to sober us up.
Well, yeah. and it wasn't just beer. I mean, everybody didn't embrace coffee and tea. The Dutch were shipping gin to England before the English started to make it, and they drank an awful lot of gin for breakfast as well.
Gin for breakfast, yeah.
Probably without tomato juice.
Probably, because tomatoes were seen as poisonous.
Some places there were, some places there weren't. The Italians accepted them readily enough, and yet, for some reason, here in North America, at least the hemisphere where tomatoes had come from, and as early as the beginning of the last century, the 20th century, people thought they were poison.
Well, in my introduction, I mentioned that for a long time in Britain, vegetables were believed to be a source of disease.
Well, there was good reason for that. In London, for example, the barges that brought fruits and vegetables to the city then carried away the contents of the city's cesspools and then reloaded and brought more vegetables.
Wash those vegetables. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. We're out of time. When will we see the abridged version of the Cambridge World History of Food?
Man, that's what my editor keeps asking. But I would hope that it'll be out within 2 years.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, thank you again.
Sure. Thank you.
Take care. Our guest this afternoon, Kenneth Kiepel, one of the editors of the Cambridge World History of Food. It's a reference work contained in two volumes. Runs more than 2,000 pages, and it was more than 10 years in the making.